a prison memoir by a crusading journalist.
People will tell me, oh, I wouldn't mind solitary. I like spending time alone. You know, this wouldn't be that bad. But solitary did not feel like spending time alone. I mean, it feels more like being buried alive. And that first time I remember as soon as I walked in the door and you know, they slammed the door behind me and I just burst into tears. Like the room was just a maddening shade of neon white and there was no clock. There was a little window slit above the bunk, but if you stood up on the bunk to look out it and they saw you, you'd get in trouble. I personally sort of just panicked and was losing track of time. It was like I was in a fugue state.
That's Carrie Blakinger. We talk with her about her powerful memoir, Corrections in Ink. Then Eve Carlin tells us about her historical novel, Track 61. It's about the invasion by a group of German saboteurs during World War II who came ashore in Amagansett, Long Island. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Carrie Blakinger was on the dean's list at Cornell University when she got arrested with a Tupperware container full of illegal drugs, including 6 ounces of heroin. The stash was partly for her own use and partly to sell to feed her heroin habit. The former skating champion and upper-middle-class striver then began a 2-year incarceration for felony drug possession, first in the county jail, then in a series of prisons in New York State. Along the way, she got clean, not because of incarceration, but in spite of it. When she got free, Blakinger became a journalist. She went on to write crusading stories about prison conditions in America, first for the Houston Chronicle and now for the Marshall Project, a nonprofit news organization covering the U.S. criminal justice system. Carrie Blakinger, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Hey, thanks for having me.
This story, Corrections in Ink, is such a powerful story of someone who defied expectations, both of the negative and the positive kind. You crashed into addiction while a student at Cornell University. You went to prison, and then you became a celebrated journalist, writing stories that have already made a huge difference. So let's start briefly at your life before addiction. You grew up in a typical middle-class suburban household, except for the fact that you became a national skating star. That's a really impressive achievement, but you also became anorexic during that time. And you describe yourself as a perfectionist and self-destructive. So talk a little bit about those two polar opposites in yourself at the time.
Well, I don't think that being a perfectionist and being self-destructive are necessarily polar opposites. I think in some ways they're, you know, sort of flip sides of the same coin and sort of closely related, because for me, I mean, I think I was just as obsessive about self-destruction as I had been about being, you know, a perfectionist before that, you know. But I also think that figure skating sort of can really foster a very all or nothing mindset in some ways. You know, it's the sort of sport where, you know, your success is very clear. Like, sure, there's some subjectivity in whether you get first or you get fifth, but you fall or you land. And I think that that fosters viewing success in very black and white terms. And I think that when that falls apart, when that goes south, then I was being sort of very black and white about it. On the one hand, I was being a perfectionist in school, even when I was doing drugs. And I was being, you know, when I was later doing drugs. And I was being a perfectionist at the rink when, you know, in my younger years when I was skating. And then in the sort of black and white duality of it, I was at the same time sort of aggressively self-destructing through eating disorders while I was skating, and then later through drug use when I was older.
Do you think that skating fostered that in you, or is just that's what you brought to?
I think it's both. I mean, I think that I have always been intense and obsessive and, you know, prone to depression, and I've always had a dark side. But I think that being in a sport like skating probably really exacerbated some of that, or, you know, just sort of heightened the extent to which those personality, I don't want to say traits, but quirks maybe, sort of took over.
Mm. Now, fast forward, at the end of 2010, while you were a student at Cornell, you got arrested with 6 ounces of heroin, which is actually a lot, and a bunch of other drugs. You got locked up in the county jail. Here you were on the dean's list, a Cornell student, never been in jail before. What was that experience like when you first hit the county jail?
You know, I think that one of the things people may not expect about being locked up for the first time is how incredibly confusing it is. I think you don't necessarily appreciate how much you don't know about the system until you're in it. You know, I think that pretty much my entire understanding of jail at that point would have been through TV and movies and honestly through a lot of like Law and Order. But, you know, there's a lot of things about the intake process and about those first few days and even just basic sort of legal terms that you don't tend to learn in school. And so I had no understanding of, you know, I knew that I was supposed to get a phone call. That's what you know from like TV and movies, right? And then that actually didn't happen. I don't think I ever got that phone call. But, you know, you come in and they put me in a this dirty, you know, holding cell with glass on two sides and a dirty mattress with holes on it on the floor and like a shower stall caked in vomit. And like, you know, there's no explanation as to how long I was going to be there. I was just put in this cell and I was like, am I here forever? Like, how does this work? And then somebody comes in with food and I was still high. So I was very confused anyways. And, you know, there's no clock. I didn't know what time it was. And then, you know, they took me through the booking process and I'd never done a delousing shower before. And nobody explains it to you. They're just like, put this on your hair and stand in that shower. And, you know, you're getting strip searched, like a very intensive strip search for the first time. And they're asking you all these intake questions. And then, you know, they give you all your stuff and like send you off to a cell block. And, you know, I walked in and they slammed the bars shut behind me and everyone else was out and walking around. And I'm like, well, what did I do? How am I already locked in? Like, what happened here? And nobody tells you, like, this is just the standard. They do medical isolation for the first, you know, 3 days to 2 weeks. And these are just like little things that nobody explains. And, you know, I didn't know how to get a lawyer or when I'd be in court next or when there's bail or do I qualify for bail? How do I make bail? Who gets me money? How does this happen? Like, how do I get money on commissary? How do I buy coffee like everyone else has? Like, there's so many little things about the system that just nobody tells you. They don't sit you down when you get booked in and explain this is how it's going to work. Like, you can ask the women around you and hope that they're right. And otherwise, like, you just, it's just, you don't know. It's just very confusing. And it's a whole other world too. You know, there's just different lingo and different norms and things that are completely normal in the free world are considered, you know, rude or offensive behind bars. So you're just sort of dropped into like another planet. And it's deeply confusing and disorienting. And at the same time, you know, you're having your humanity and dignity stripped away. So a lot of the things that you would use to define yourself as a person are no longer available to you behind bars. And, you know, I think that that adds up to being just very confusing on a number of levels.
Yeah. So that was a rude introduction to a way of life that you were going to be experiencing for the next 2 years. A fellow inmate in that county jail told you to start a journal. Why do you think she said that to you?
I think she knew that I seemed like the one most likely to be a writer. But yeah, I mean, I'd only been in about 2 days and there was this older woman, she was in her 60s and the rest of us were mostly in our 20s and in for drugs. And she was in her 60s and in for DUI. And she's very nice, older pagan lesbian. And
she was the only person that was really interested in sort of watching the news every day and reading the newspaper. And we did crosswords together eventually. But in the beginning, I remember a couple days in, she was like, yeah, you should keep a journal. Someday this could make a good book, or at the very least, it's too wild to not write it all down. So I did. I went and I bought legal notepads from the commissary and started keeping extensive journals the entire time I was there.
And that was a pretty risky thing to do. Why?
Yeah, when you're locked up, anything that you have in your possession is, you know, subject to possible search and seizure. Like, you don't have any sort of right to privacy. So, you know when you're taking notes or writing something, it could get destroyed or confiscated at pretty much any time. And, you know, that meant that I, every few pages, I would mail it to someone on the outside, because I didn't want the staff to be able to read it and use it against me, you know. And obviously there's some things you just don't write down. There's some things that are just that you witness that are just too risky to write down at all. I guess a lot of those things are the sorts of things that didn't make it into the book anyway. But with the things that I did write down, I still had to be cautious. Just talking trash about staff, or, you know, gossip about something that other prisoners are doing, or, you know, things that are observations about your surroundings that could be considered a security risk. Like, all of these things can have consequences.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with journalist Carrie Blakinger about her memoir, Corrections in Ink. It's about her experience serving time for a felony drug conviction and how that led to her work covering the U.S. criminal justice system. You write really powerfully about what you call the terrifying randomness of jail life, which really, as I was reading your book, Carrie Blakinger, Corrections in Ink, it felt to me that that is the worst thing about it, the most dehumanizing, the cruelest, the most disempowering part of being behind bars. Talk about that terrifying randomness and how it manifested.
You know, I think that there's a lot of ways in which prison and jail are just not the sort of stable and unchanging worlds that you might think they are. I think when you think about prison, you think like these are just people sort of sitting there in their cells for hours, days, months, years, and that it would be very sort of predictable and every day is the same. And that's generally true. But then there's also this just, you know, there's always this sort of overriding threat of just random bad things, basically. One of them is that, you know, no matter, you know, at any point with sort of no warning, you can be transferred. And that sounds like a small thing, but I mean, I don't know. Imagine if you're living somewhere and you have suddenly no notice and you have to move to a different house, you know, within an hour. Like, it's, you know, it's actually very destabilizing, because you might have friends or whatever, you might be involved in college programs or vocational classes. You know, you have property and belongings. You might have to give a lot of that away to pack it up and get transferred. And sometimes when I was in county jail, if you got transferred to another jail, you would be put in solitary for anywhere from like 3 days to 2 weeks as soon as you hit the new jail. So every transfer also meant solitary, even though you hadn't done anything wrong. You were effectively being punished. And, you know, you never knew. So every time that like a new girl came in, and we'd be seeing someone in booking and we'd be doing the math, like, were we overcrowded? Is someone going to get sent to another jail? And, you know, we'd all panic, because if you got sent to another jail, aside from the solitary, and aside from the fact that you're losing, you know, your friends and, you know, probably some of your possessions, you're also it's going to be harder for people to visit you when you're further from home. And it's going to be a lot more expensive for people to call you. And you have to deal with getting entered into their phone system and having several days without access to phones. So you can't get calls from your kids or your lawyer or your parents. And, you know, there's all these things about the transfer process that are just awful, whether you're talking about jail to jail or prison to prison. And, you know, I think the fact that can sort of happen at any moment, you can be doing nothing wrong and just end up in solitary or just whisked off to a completely different place. You know, part of it's obviously a lack of, you know, I think plays into this sort of lack of agency that you have when you're locked up. But it's also, it feels incredibly random and destabilizing.
And talking about solitary, I mean, the UN has said that solitary confinement is torture. it really seems to be the default method. I mean, it's just so overused. I mean, I think any use of solitary confinement is overuse, but it just seems to be the any excuse is good enough to throw someone in solitary. Tell us about solitary confinement and your first experience of it.
Yeah, so the first time that, actually, I guess it wasn't quite the first time, but the time that I was in solitary that has stuck with me the most was when, I was describing the transfer process, and I was transferred from one jail to another. And at the new jail, you know, they did the thing where they routinely do medical isolation. And this was not the first time I'd been in solitary, but it was the first time I'd been in solitary with a solid door, because the jail that I went to first when I got arrested had metal cell bars in the front of each cell instead of like a solid door. And then when I got to this new jail, it was a solid door. And that is real solitary. You can't just sort of chat with people strolling by. And, you know, I remember thinking, you know, it didn't seem like it was going to be that bad. And I hear that a lot now. Like, people will tell me, oh, I wouldn't mind solitary. I like spending time alone. You know, this wouldn't be that bad. But solitary did not feel like spending time alone. I mean, it feels more like being buried alive. And that first time I remember as soon as I walked in the door and, you know, they slammed the door behind me and I just burst into tears. Like, the room was just a maddening shade of neon white, and there was no clock. There was a little window slit above the bunk, but if you stood up on the bunk to look out it and they saw you, you'd get in trouble. I didn't have any property with me because I'd just been transferred. So I think I had a Bible with me, and I later got a copy of like Seabiscuit to read. Because a Bible was the one thing you knew you could bring from one facility to another. That's the one thing they wouldn't stop you from bringing. I'm not religious, but I, you know, brought a Bible with me so that I have something to read, and also so that I could write friends' addresses on the inner margins, because that was the only way you could bring friends' addresses and phone numbers, was if you somehow smuggled them in through, you know, a religious text. But, you know, that was it. That was all I had. And, you know, you have no way to tell time, and it's very disorienting. And, you know, I personally sort of just panicked and was losing track of time. It was like I was in a fugue state. And I know that not everyone reacts that strongly to solitary that quickly. I think some people it takes a lot more time to see the real effects of that. But to me, that was just terrifying. It felt like, I don't know, like just sort of like being a mind in a void. I mean, I think that solitary fundamentally eats away at like two of the things that that really define us as humans. And that is how we interact with other people, like interactions with other humans, like the relationships with other people, like defining self in relation to other. And you don't have that in solitary. You know, you're not interacting with other people. And then I think the other thing is, you know, we define ourselves by our actions are the choices we make, the things we do, and your world becomes so small and you have so little agency when you're in solitary. And I don't know, it seems to me like interacting with other humans and making choices are just two of the very fundamental things about being human. And solitary really eats away at both of those.
The dehumanization and the cruelty, not just solitary, but all the other myriad ways that you write in Corrections and Ink, Carrie Blakinger, they seem to me that they aren't a bug, but actually the point. How did we get from rehabilitation, which is something I remember from the 1970s, 60s and 70s, to such a malevolent, soul-destroying punishment focus in the prison system?
Well, I mean, I think that's actually... I mean, I can give my thoughts, but I think there are some really great books that dive into that. That's such an academic question in some ways. Like, I mean, it's a question for an academic is what I mean. But I mean, I think that part of this has to do with the war on drugs and, you know, increasing the size of our prison system. I also think that, you know, over time, there are sort of ebbs and flows as to whether societies believe more in rehabilitation or whether they are more focused on punishment. But I also think in the case of what has happened in the US over the past few decades, like it would have been realistically not even possible to build up a prison system to the size that we have built ours up to and still have it actually focused on rehabilitation. It just would be too expensive. You know, it is expensive to care for people at even a bare minimum constitutional level, let alone provide adequate rehabilitative services and also spend enough on their care and treatment that you're still sort of preserving their basic dignity. And I know that some people might think that's just sort of coddling prisoners, but the reality is if you don't respect them as humans and you don't treat them with dignity, like you're not really setting them up for success afterwards. You can't sort of just dehumanize and abuse people for years and expect them to come out rehabilitated or more productive citizens or more likely to contribute to the community. And I think that, you know, just the cost of doing it in a less destructive way would have been so prohibitive. I don't know how mass incarceration could have possibly happened in a rehabilitation focused way.
More costly in the short term, possibly not in the long term.
Well, I mean, yeah, I don't know, actually. I mean, when you're talking about as many people as we've locked up for as long as we've locked them up, I mean, there's a lot of medical costs too. You know, I think it's easier to say that, you know, treating people well and then hoping that you save money on the back end when they don't recidivate. I think that's actually probably an easier argument to make when you're talking about shorter terms. But during the, you know, uptick in drug sentencing in the 80s and 90s, I mean, some of these people were getting, you know, decades in life for nonviolent drug offenses. And I'm not sure that, I mean, that alone would just be so expensive. I'm not sure that any amount of rehabilitation was going to make that less expensive. I mean, it seems to me the thing that is less expensive is to just not be building up the prison system to the size that we did.
Good point. Now, you did rehabilitate, I guess. You rehabilitated yourself in prison. You got sober. You got clearer. You got more grounded, more balanced. At one point in Corrections and Inc., you tell another inmate that the psychological health you gained in prison was in spite of, not because of your experience there. What are the factors that helped you do that?
You know, I think that, I mean, I think there's a lot of things. I mean, first of all, I think that I was at a point where I was ready to make a change. And I think if I'd gotten arrested a year earlier, I wasn't there. And I think I would have kept trying to, you know, I would have kept getting drugs in prison because, you know, you can get drugs in prison. I could get heroin delivered to my bedside when I was locked up. But I think I was at a point where I was ready to be done with it. And I think that made a huge difference. And I think part of that was also about that I was getting towards the age where people tend to age out of crime, you know. But then I also was incredibly lucky that when I got out, I had, you know, a good support system. I had, you know, I had a place to live. I had a family that could support me and help me get a car to get to a job. You know, I benefited racial privilege and class privilege in ways that made it easier for me to reintegrate afterwards in society than it would have for people who make up a larger portion of the prison demographic.
Yes, those are what you call collateral consequences. And you talk about extrajudicial punishments. I mean, it's not just that people don't have the resources that you had, but that they come out burdened with a whole lot of consequences from being in prison. And you faced some of those as well, although you were able to overcome, you know, substantially overcome them. Just give us a couple of examples.
Yeah, well, I don't want to conflate collateral consequences with, you know, issues of privilege, because I mean, I think collateral consequences are typically concrete consequences that apply to everyone. And certainly people of color might be more impacted by them. But I mean, collateral consequences apply to me or to anyone who has a felony. You know, for instance, you know, I still, more than a decade later, have trouble finding an apartment. I've actually realized that I generally just can't, and I have to find a friend who has a spare room to rent me. I get disqualified from a lot of housing. Even just subletting from strangers is hard because of the felony, you know, but also collateral consequences can be weird and unexpected. Like, you know, technically dating apps ban people with felonies, you know, Airbnb has restrictions on people with felonies. You know, in when I was working in Lower Manhattan, working overnights for the New York Daily News, I remember being troubled that I couldn't carry pepper spray. You know, I'd be walking through deserted streets home from work at 5 a.m. and on the subway at 5 a.m. and I couldn't carry pepper spray with, as a felon. You know, but the most common one is really about employment. And like, I obviously I do have a job, but I have definitely been rejected from jobs because of felony. And then more commonly, when I am, you know, rejected or overlooked or don't get a call back, I'll never know why. I won't know if it's because somebody saw the felony and was just like, I don't want to hire this, you know, this felon. So I think that a lot of the collateral consequences we can understand in the broader picture. We can look at data, you know, we can look at hiring practices, we can look at other things, but I think it's often really difficult to pinpoint, like, this was a collateral consequence of my particular felony. And obviously, you know, yes, I've been incredibly fortunate to be able to rebuild and get a second chance. But, you know, those collateral consequences are real for a lot of us. And I think that people I talk to are commonly very surprised that for someone who has a nonviolent decade-old felony, that it actually still has the impact that it does.
Now, one thing led to another, and you ended up at the Houston Chronicle writing about prisons, and you've been able to do a really an enormous amount of good there. But you're perhaps most proud about getting Texas prisoners' teeth. Tell us about that.
Yeah, one of the stories I did when I was at the Houston Chronicle was about how the Texas prison system has routinely denied people dentures. And if you didn't have teeth, instead of, you know, giving you dentures, they would take your mess hall meal and put it in a blender and puree it, pour it in a cup and serve it to you that way. And when I first heard this, I was shocked because in New York, if you didn't have teeth, they would give you dentures. And it didn't occur to me that it would be so different elsewhere that a prison system would deny people an entire body part. So I started looking into it and I spent about 11 months investigating, and I found people who were impacted by this policy, and I put in records requests for copies of the policy, and I put in records requests for data. And in the end, I published a story about, you know, about the lack of dentures. And afterwards, there was one particular state lawmaker who was so incensed by the whole thing and how the prison system was handling it that he leaned on them to do better. And they ended up deciding to buy a 3D printer for one of the prisons so that they could 3D print dentures on site.
So has that become more general in the Texas prisons?
That is a great question. It did, and they did it for more prisoners. But the status of things right now is actually something that I'm currently investigating. So I don't know. Look for a story on that soon.
We will. People think that nothing they do is going to make a difference. And you really do show in this wonderful book, Corrections and Ink, how journalism can make a difference, and also how writing such a terrific memoir can as well. Carrie Blakinger, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thanks for having me.
Carrie Blakinger. Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from Corrections in Ink. Next up, a historical novel about a German invasion on Long Island during World War II. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Sign up for the free Writer's Voice podcast and weekly newsletter at writersvoice.net. Just after midnight on June 13, 1942, four German saboteurs invaded the territory of the United States on a beach just 5 miles from where I live. They came ashore in Amagansett, Long Island, bent on a Nazi mission to disrupt rail transport and sow chaos. As a child, my guest Eve Carlin spent summers at a cottage near the landing site. Her grandmother, who lived with her, was a refugee from Nazi Germany. Carlin weaves a tale inspired by these two strands of history, the Amagansett invasion and her grandmother's story, in her new novel, Track 61. It's a coming-of-age story compellingly told, with a young teenager named Greta faced with moral choices that pit her feelings against her loyalties. Eve Carlin is the author of a previous novel, City of Liars and Thieves. She lives in East Hampton, New York. Eve Carlin, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
Track 61, just to start out, a little historical fact. On 1240 a.m., June 13th, 1942, a German U-boat deposited four German saboteurs on Atlantic Beach in Amagansett on Long Island. What made you want to write a novel based on this story?
Well, I have a connection to Amagansett. I spent my whole life here, and I was aware of the saboteur landing. When I started to research my second book, I knew I wanted to find a New York City story. And I started to look at Grand Central Station, which has always interested me because I find it just such a beautiful site. So many architectural details. Looking into Grand Central, I discovered something called Track 61, which is an abandoned rail spur underneath the station that was used to transport distinguished guests. Most notably, FDR used Track 61 when he came to New York City in the 30s and the 40s during his presidency, both to hide his disability and to be safe. And as I looked into Track 61, I uncovered the connection with the Nazi saboteurs who landed 2 miles from where I grew up. And I knew I had the makings of a really great story.
Yeah, so the protagonist is Grete, who's named after your grandmother. Tell us about Grete and why you named her after your grandma.
So I grew up in this Amagansett house with my parents and my sister and my maternal grandparents, who were German Jews who had fled Hitler. And the irony that I had grown up and my grandmother had taken care of me on the very same stretch of sand where these Nazi saboteurs landed struck me as ironic. And I started to weave the stories together. Because my grandmother was a young woman in the 40s. She had fled Nazi Germany, and she was a terrific character. And it seemed just like kind of an organic, natural connection to make.
So was she like your protagonist, Grete? And tell us about Grete.
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm really happy to say that she was. And I wasn't aware of it when I started writing, but as I started writing, I felt I was able to incorporate a lot of my grandmother's stories that I had heard since childhood. She was a very vibrant, wonderful person, and it was really easy to create a character based on her.
So Greta lives with her uncle Jacques, and tell us, how did she get to New York City?
Well, Greta, the character, came to New York on a ship and moved in with her paternal uncle, which is actually the same thing that happened to my grandmother. She left her parents behind in Germany to close down family business, to take care of things. And she traveled to New York. My grandmother had actually a twin brother, but it made it too complicated for the book, so I took him out. But they came. They were named Hansel and Gretel, of course, because they were German twins. And they came to New York together and stayed with my great uncle Jack, who was a bachelor in New York at the time.
Before we go any further on Greta, though, tell us about the four saboteurs and exactly, you know, what happened, what they were doing here. Because you do closely base those characters on at least the events surrounding the actual saboteurs who came here.
Right, yeah. The four saboteurs were members of something called Operation Pistorius, which actually in total were eight men who trained for only 3 weeks in Germany and then were transported to France, where they boarded two separate U-boats. 4 men landed off the coast of Florida, 4 others off the coast of Amagansett. I chose, because of my personal connection, to focus on the men who landed in Amagansett. And as I looked into their story, you know, initially they were Nazi saboteurs to me. As I looked into it and researched and read the trial transcript from their military tribunal, they became more human to me, especially one character that I chose to focus on, whose name is Peter Berger. George Dash is another character that is a central character in the book, and I was privileged to read his memoir, which he penned after the events.
And so tell us a little bit about these characters.
Well, Peter, who is the main character, had spent, as had all the saboteurs, had spent, you know, years and years in America. They all had American accents, spoke English fluently, and that was the appeal of rounding up these men and having them participate in this mission. Peter was a member of the National Guard. My understanding is he went back to Germany in the early 30s because of family, and he did become a member of the Nazi Party. So certainly that would make one less sympathetic towards him. That said, he was a journalist. He was assigned to Poland. He came back to Germany and reported on Nazi atrocities in Poland. And because of his report, he was put in a Gestapo prison for 17 months. On his release, my understanding is he had very little choice but to join this group of saboteurs. He had family. They were being threatened. His wife was threatened and became ill because of the pressure. So, I mean, as I looked into it, I started to wonder what anyone would do in those circumstances. And are you a traitor because of where you live, what border you are, you know, living, what country you live under? It's a difficult thing, and I don't want to presume what I would do under those circumstances if my family were being threatened. And I was told to participate in a sabotage mission. He wasn't a guard at a concentration camp. You know, there are so many worse things that someone could have done during the war. I found myself seeing him as a human being and not necessarily as a terrible person.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Eve Carlin about her novel, Track 61. And yet you do outline in the book what the sabotage that at least the fictional characters are planning would have done, which could have cost thousands of lives.
Absolutely. The sabotage mission, had it succeeded, would have been detrimental to the war effort, I firmly believe. That said, without giving too much away, Peter and George weren't necessarily 100% on board with that mission. They had no choice but to be on that U-boat. They had no choice but to land in the United States. Once here, which makes up the bulk of the story, they had choices which they acted on.
A lot of this is public knowledge. So okay. George and Peter, you say they seemed less involved. And in fact, of the 8 saboteurs who were arrested, all 8 were arrested, they were the only 2 who escaped the electric chair. Why was that?
Because Peter and George came forward. The saboteurs landed in Amagansett. They evaded capture. They made their way to New York City, needles in a haystack. They met with the other saboteurs there. They had meetings. And George called the FBI, and Peter helped him. And George turned himself in and said that Peter was aiding him. Those 2 men turned themselves in and ultimately were pardoned, I don't think by Roosevelt, by Truman.
So let's go back to the story. This is also a kind of love story. And one of the things I really like about this novel, Eve Carlin, Track 61, is you allow for the nuances of real life. You've just alluded to it. You know, if you were in a different circumstance, would you have done the same thing? I mean, it's a question a lot of us ask when we think about those people who, you know, were heroes in any particular situation, for example, in World War II, or those who were not. So we really don't know. Greta meets Peter at a parade in New York City later in the day after he's landed in Amagansett. He takes a train into New York. Tell us about that parade.
The parade is an actual event that happened in Manhattan on Flag Day of 1942. The photographs and the footage is fabulous to look at. It was the largest military parade in U.S. history with an estimated 2 million spectators. And the floats are quite incredible. So I had a lot of fun watching the footage of the parade, seeing the patriotism, imagining my characters, Peter, who very well might have been there, and Greta, my grandmother, who could have been there, among the spectators.
Mm. And say a little bit more about that. I mean, the kind of jingoism of the parade, I think one can certainly understand. I mean, even there's some nuance because Greta doesn't feel altogether comfortable there. So talk about this parade.
Right. What draws my characters together, certainly, you know, World War II was, once we were involved, it goes without saying, there was a lot of patriotism at that point for and support. But, and this is true, my grandmother, being a German Jew, having a heavy accent, living apart from her parents, she was a popular outgoing girl, as I understand it, at home. She was a champion swimmer. So she was thrust into an environment where she felt like I'm sure so many refugees feel, like an outsider. So part of what draws her to Peter is their outsidedness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you also talk about this is a time of the Japanese internment, which we learn about through Greta's eyes, and her Jewishness. You know, she wasn't accepted because she was German. She wasn't accepted because she was Jewish. So. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit more about why you included these elements of, I guess, questioning the xenophobia of America at that time, even though it was certainly understandable.
Well, I think when anyone is uprooted and anyone is faced with war, and certainly a young girl, a young person, and this feeling of being an outsider, putting myself in those shoes, felt her vulnerability. One of the questions when I was weaving these stories together was, why would this character become involved knowing what she's learning about this nefarious plot? And part of the reason is because she felt not like an outsider who wanted to harm the U.S., but someone who wanted to do good, who wanted to, who had so little chance to have any say in the events that were happening in her life. And in this instance, she was able to make a small impact.
And why does she get involved with Peter so quickly? They basically meet and the connection is immediate.
I think the more she learns about Peter, the more she learns about his plight, the more she learns about what he's risking and what he's trying to do. And remember, this is historical fiction, so I can only just imagine that these were his intentions. But from my perspective, the more she felt that she was able to contribute in some small way to this new country that was giving her a new home, she wanted to help.
But she didn't want to help the sabotage.
Absolutely not. She wanted to put an end to the sabotage mission, which was ultimately, as we said, George and Peter did contact, not ultimately, actually, right away. The second evening they're in the United States, they reach out to the FBI.
They were called not the Keystone Cops, but it was the Keystone Commandos. Mm-hmm. It is kind of a bizarre story. They didn't seem to be all that good at their job.
Yeah, that's what has come down to us through history, that these men were kind of bumbling and they blew everything. I'm not sure that that's how I see the situation. Hoover took a lot of credit for having captured these men, and it really helped his career tremendously. But the truth is, he didn't capture them, nor most likely would they have been captured. Initially, when they called the FBI, their call was just ignored. They thought these were a bunch of, I think the word was crackpots, who were just making prank calls. It wasn't until George got on a train from New York, went to Washington, D.C., and actually even showed them the amount of money he had been given to fulfill this mission, that they took him seriously. So it really was just something that Hoover took credit for.
It was some $80,000.
Yeah, which I forget exactly what that translates to today, but an awful lot of money to have in pocket.
Right, and initially, I believe they were, George and Peter were sentenced to death. And in your author's note at the end of the book, you critique this trial. You say it was deeply problematic. Talk about that.
It's not just me who critiques this trial. A lot of people had a problem with the trial because it was a military tribunal, and in the midst of the trial, the Supreme Court actually met in a summer session, which was unprecedented, to debate the legality of putting these men, trying them in a military tribunal. Because this wasn't an area of war, and because they were dressed in civilian clothing, it was interesting how much what they were wearing when they were captured factored into whether they would be tried as prisoners of war, as spies, as civilians. But the other thing that was problematic with the trial was that FDR appointed the tribunal and then served as the final decision maker. So there were a lot of things that people to this day question about the legality of the trial. And, you know, 8 men were sentenced to death. It was the largest execution of prisoners in the U.S. since, I think, John Wilkes Booth's conspirators were hung.
And what was the reaction? This was a big case?
Well, it's interesting. When the men were captured, it was front page news. Of course, we are in a time of war. But as the trial proceeded, you know, it got more and more buried into the folds of the newspaper. So I would say it wasn't headline news. Once they were executed, it certainly wasn't, you know, first and foremost in the news.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Eve Carlin about her novel, Track 61. So you must have done a huge amount of historical research in this, and this is your second historical novel. Now, talk a little bit about, you know, your sources and the process and some of the challenges of the research that you did.
Well, I think that this is my second historical novel, and I've learned an awful lot through writing both my books. I think I like to strike on a story that I feel a personal connection to, and I think it's amazing how when you find that, the other connections that just come to the surface, there's so much. That said, in this instance, I mean, the internet, I think, is amazing. There is a 3,000-page trial transcript that now exists that one can read from the tribunal. That was just so important to understanding and listening to the personal statements of all these men. There have also been many nonfiction accounts written about this, accounts that also focus on the justice system. I read certainly all of that, and it was all very interesting. The harder part, I think, is taking it from that realm, and then, which is the beauty of historical fiction, and putting it into a book that one can relate to, that one hears the voices. It's something that has more life, that's a little less dry than a nonfiction account. And that's also the fun.
Yes, and I think you do that very well. So, you know, when I was asking about the historical research, I also meant how you bring the flavor, the details of the time to life. You know, what were some of the other sources that you had in order to create the world as in New York City as it existed at that time?
I watched lots of movies, which I highly recommend, set in the 40s. I read lots of books. One tries to pick up on the speech. George Dash, for instance, in his memoir, he had a very distinct way of speaking. He spent many, many years in the States, but he loved to use all sorts of slang that didn't really fall naturally. That almost felt as if he were someone, a foreigner, trying to become more American by using slang. So all these things I hoped to bring to the writing to make it ring more true, certainly.
You also had to do some research on what happened to German Jews and how they came over here. So talk about Gurs. I'm not sure how to pronounce it, the concentration camp in France. Mm-hmm. How did Greta's family, who were German, end up in France?
Well, my grandmother's from Mannheim. Her family was spread out between Germany, France, and Belgium. Actually, my understanding is there was a roundup in Mannheim of German Jews, and all those there were transported to the camp in France, Gurs, as you say. I have some photos. My great-grandparents were not there, but my grandmother's aunts and uncles and relatives were there. I have letters from them. That they wrote trying to ask their family to get them out, to send funds, to prove that they had relatives in France that would be responsible. And in that way, they were able, not all of them. Some of them were then transported to Auschwitz, but others were freed to be with their family in France and make their way here.
You wrote the author's note to this book, Eve Carlin, to Track 61. On June 28, 2021, it was the day after your grandmother had died peacefully in her sleep the night before. At the age of 101, did she know about the book? Mm-hmm. And what did she make of it?
She knew about the book. She shared so many photos. One of the photos, or one of the stories in the book, is about my grandmother's dog. She had a German Shepherd named Stromer, which I think kind of translates to like vagabond or tramp. She loved the dog. I have a photograph of the dog in a party hat with her on a birthday. The dog, my understanding is, a dog like that, a well-bred German Shepherd, some of them were taken by Gestapo and used, strangely, for soldiers to become friends with, use them, and then as a test to shoot the dog. So my understanding, and this is a story my grandmother told me through tears, her father took their dog to the backyard and shot the dog so that the dog wouldn't be used by the Gestapo. And certainly so many people and so many horrible things happened to people during the war. But as a young child, that was a story that really resonated with me. I had a dog. I could relate to that. And I thought to myself, my God, what if someone, you know. So all these things, I think, really made the story more real. Anything that's actually true mm-hmm. always resonates.
What was your biggest challenge in writing this book?
This book, I think, was, you know, it follows basically a chronological order. So it was, I would say for my first book, which was Quakers, that was certainly a challenge regarding speech, using Quaker speech. This book, I would say trying to get speech, trying not to be too modern, but also realizing that people who lived in the 40s in many ways are as free thinking, were as free thinking as modern. Some people said to me, would a woman in the 40s behave this way? And I'm thinking, I think so. I think, you know, human nature is human nature. And I think that there's a balance there, trying to strike the right tone for the era, but also making these people ring true.
I would also think that one thing that might be difficult is her, Greta's relationship to Peter, because she's never really sure if she can trust him, trust herself. She, you know, if he's really a saboteur, she would be betraying her own family. So how did you deal with that kind of nuance?
The more as a writer I learned about Peter and the more I kind of felt that there was some dignity in his character, the easier it became. That said, I think one of the biggest challenges was creating a situation for her to become involved. The other thing that's interesting to me, and I think this happens when you write a book, people say, oh, this is a love story. And in many ways, you know, there are those threads, but in many ways there aren't. What a young girl sees and what someone like Peter fighting for his life here in the United States sees, I felt like were two different things. These characters did not know each other. The storyline is focused on the week Peter spent in New York before he was arrested. So what a young girl of 16 is imagining and what a man on a life-threatening mission is trying to do are two separate things. So how much of the love story is through Greta's eyes and how much of that is returned?
Well, it is a propulsive read. Track 61, Eve Carlin, thanks so much for talking with us about it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Eve Carlin. In addition to Track 61, she's the author of another historical novel, City of Liars and Thieves. She lives in East Hampton, New York. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter @writersvoice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.